From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Diane Ravitch on the need for multicultural history curriculums that don't distort history in the name of ethnic pride. Ravitch is an education historian and co-writer of California's new public school history curriculum. Also today, we remember a small group of actors that transformed acting in America. We talk with Wendy Smith, the author of a new history of the group theater. Rock historian Ed Ward examines the life of John Cale. And John Leonard reviews a new book on the ancient city of Angkor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Bush has reiterated his stand not to negotiate with Iraq. He says that all means must be used to make Baghdad understand that it must withdraw from Kuwait. Bush has proposed that Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz visit the White House next week, and that Secretary of State James Baker go to Iraq to talk with Iraqi President Hussein. The president has expressed support for Defense Secretary Richard Cheney, who says the surest way to get Iraq out of Kuwait is by military intervention rather than international sanctions. Officials of Jordan and Yemen met in Baghdad with Iraqi President Hussein today before his upcoming talks with the United States, NPR's Jackie Leiden reports.
Jordan and Yemen are the two Arab countries closest to Iraq. Never before have they together gone to see President Saddam Hussein. But that's what King Hussein of Jordan and Yemen's vice president, Ali Salam al-Bey, have done. Diplomats in Amman say they'll put pressure on Saddam Hussein to be reasonable in talks with the United States and to consider negotiating. He has to keep in mind that he will not be the only one to suffer if there is a war, a diplomat said. Whether that means King Hussein will urge Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait isn't clear, and whether Saddam Hussein would listen to that is also uncertain. But Yemen and Jordan, while being fully sympathetic to Iraq, are likely to also attempt to be pragmatic and urge Saddam to listen. I'm Jackie Leiden in Amman.
British Prime Minister John Major is echoing his predecessor, Margaret Thatcher, and calling for no partial solutions to the Persian Gulf crisis. He has also ruled out negotiations with Iraq. Aides say that the prime minister plans to travel soon to the Gulf to visit with troops and to confer with leaders in the area. The Soviet Parliament has approved in principle President Gorbachev's plans for changes in the federal government. Under the plans, Gorbachev would have the authority to appoint and dismiss ministers, appoint a vice president, and have a cabinet-like body which will take care of internal Soviet affairs. The BBC's Kevin Connolly reports from Moscow.
Mr. Gorbachev's plans, which, as liberal critics say, will place too much power in his hands, promise a sweeping reform of a system of government which, in recent months, has shown signs of breaking down. All ministers, including the Prime Minister, will be answerable directly to him. That concentration of authority, he says, is the only way to avoid what he's described as a paralysis of power. But his performance in Parliament was unusually subdued, and he gave no details of who is to fill the jobs on offer in the new administration. It even remains a possibility that the much-criticised Prime Minister, Nikolai Ryzhkov, who's come to be seen as a champion of the powerful and conservative-minded bureaucracy, may hang on to some form of office. There'd been speculation that the premier's job was to be abolished.
The BBC's Kevin Connolly. On Wall Street, stock prices closed up today. The Dow averaged closed up just over 14 points to 2579.70. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some of us look back on our public school history classes and remember how dull some of our teachers managed to make the past. But the teaching of history is really a loaded subject. Educators designing a history curriculum have to decide how to interpret the most difficult issues of the past, issues of war and peace, slaves and slave owners, freedom of religion, religious tyranny, and so on. How to present historical controversies in a meaningful way to students of different racial, religious, and ethnic groups is a subject to which Diane Ravitch has given considerable thought. Ravitch was one of the principal writers of the K-12 history and social science curriculum for the state of California. She's an education historian, a professor at Columbia University Teachers College, and the author of the books The Schools We Deserve, What Do Our 17-Year-Olds Know?, and The Troubled Crusade, American Education, 1945 to 1980. Her new book is a multicultural anthology of history and literature called The American Reader. Ravitch is an advocate of multicultural curriculums, but she's against what she calls particularism. I asked her to explain the difference.
Well, what I've been trying to do in my work and in the articles I've written has been to define multiculturalism as pluralism and to say that ethnocentrism or particularism is not pluralism. And if you say, for instance, that you want to immerse yourself or your students completely in one strain, whether it's everything white, everything black, everything Hispanic, this is not pluralism. Now, it's possible in a school setting or in a college setting to, of course, do black studies or Hispanic studies or any other kind of studies, and that's fine. But I think that in teaching American history, particularly, that what you want to look for is the exchanges between people, the interchange, the interdependence, the fact that we're all part of this country and the society, and that the society has changed over time and continues to change over time. So I look not for the separateness and not for a sense of what I would consider a segregated curriculum, which I think some cities are moving towards today, but rather a curriculum in which we learn more about each other and we come to understand that we do, in fact, have a common culture with a lot of different streams in it that are all now part of the mainstream.
You've said that particularism is motivated by raising self-esteem and providing role models. Well, what's bad with that?
Well, we don't know whether segregated education actually does raise self-esteem. In fact, it may not. My notion, and I could be wrong, but my idea of self-esteem is that it's the product of doing something that you value and that others value. For instance, if you doubt your ability to do something, the best way to get your self-esteem raised is to do that task and do it well. You also get self-esteem by helping other people. There are many ways to get self-esteem. If your parents are wonderful to you and they make you feel good, then that you get self-esteem that way. But I don't think that the way education proceeds is that you can dole out self-esteem by coming to believe that you're descended from whatever ancient ancestors. I think that's a certain kind of mythology.
I think what it's designed to be is an antidote to having been told for years or generations that you're inferior because of your religion or your ethnicity or the color of your skin.
Well, I don't think that anyone should be told that they are inferior because of religion, race, or ethnicity. In a pluralistic curriculum, it's very clear that people who do great things come from all civilizations and all colors and all religions. I think that it's very dangerous in history, particularly, to use history as a kind of self-esteem builder, because one of the things we learn in the study of history is that human beings of all races, colors, creeds, and ethnicities are capable of all sorts of terrible things. So that you would learn from history, I would imagine, if you took it seriously, a tremendous sense of humility. And that what counts is the kind of human being you are, and your caring for other people, and your ability to see other people and not see a skin color, not see a religion, not see an accent, not see age, but rather to care about human beings as such. That's an awfully hard thing to do, but to me that's the lesson of history, is that racism is always wrong. Ethnocentrism has tremendously negative consequences.
Diane Ravitch is my guest, and she's written extensively about education, and she's put together an anthology called The American Reader. Let's see what we can apply of this in practical terms. Now, you were one of the participants in rewriting the history and social science curriculums for the state of California.
Yes.
What were some of the problems with the existing curriculum that you were trying to correct with the rewriting?
What we tried to do in California with the history curriculum was to try to bring back history. There had been many complaints nationally as well as in California that kids didn't know much about history. So we set out, first of all, to construct a curriculum that would be interesting to children, that would be exciting to them, that would introduce them to important men and women, not only in American history but throughout the world, and that would give them an understanding of the connection between past and present. So among the things we did, because this is, I think it's very important in that it shows that pluralism works as a curricular concept, is we did the most radical thing that any curriculum committee has done anywhere in the United States. We introduced 3 years of required world history. And when I say that it's world history, I'm not speaking of Western history, or I'm not speaking of Western and non-Western history, I'm speaking of world history. And that is to say that in the sixth grade, all the children in California will have and now have a course in ancient history. In seventh grade, they have a course in history in the Middle Ages, and it's a world course, both of these courses. And then in the third year, which is the 10th grade, they have a course in modern world history. And there are some themes that run through this. There's great attention to ethics. We look at the religions of the civilizations of the world. We try to see history in a very broad and latitudinarian fashion so that when we look at different civilizations, we look at things like their art, their literature, their government, the idea of human rights. How did people, have any rights? How did the government get its power? What was the society like? What was the economy like? What were the religious beliefs? What was the daily life? What was ordinary life like for people? What were the things they believed in? And we did a kind of remarkable thing at the same time. We said to textbook publishers, pretend that you don't have a captive audience. Pretend that you have to win the respect of your reader as if people who read these books actually went out and bought them. This was a brand new concept in textbook publishing. What we did in the American history was we said 3 years of required American world, history, and this is not new because that had been the case in California before, but we introduced into American history an attention to pluralism, and that was close attention, not just pretend attention and not just remember to mention a few blacks and a few women. We said that in all of the writing and telling of American history, there must be attention to the basically pluralistic, multicultural nature of American society and recognition that this is true not just for the recent past, but this has been true from the beginning, that the those who lived here before Europeans arrived had cultures and that their culture had to be understood. And we then look at all of the different cultures and the interchanges between cultures, which is very important to do. So we don't, this is why having seen the development of a curriculum in which there is cultural interchange, I'm very opposed to an Afrocentric curriculum, a Hispanocentric curriculum, a curriculum where children are in a sense, treated to a kind of segregated approach to their own culture and not to others.
I'm wondering if this emphasis on multiculturalism through world history isn't a very far removed way of getting multiculturalism into students' curriculums. It's harder for you to find the student sitting next to you or sharing your block with you through world history. Do you know what I mean? Through going that far back. It seems very abstract when you're young, looking that far back.
It's actually not abstract, and the difference in approach is this, and I think it's, in learning history, I think it's very important to learn about things rather than to learn to believe in things. Now, if you want to go to parochial schools, you might want to learn to believe in things, but in a public school and in a university, we learn about. So, for instance, in the ancient history course and in the Middle Ages course, there is quite a lot of attention to African history. And there is, in the textbooks that were based on this curriculum that were just published by Houghton Mifflin, there is very careful and very attentive treatment of the African kingdoms of Mali and Ghana and Songhai. Now, the idea is not to say learn to identify with these kingdoms, but rather that all children, regardless of whether they're Asian or black or Hispanic or white or whatever their ethnicity, this is very interesting. These were important civilizations in world history, and you should know about them because of their intrinsic interest. This is very different from saying because you are of this skin color, you can identify with this civilization. The idea is that in the classes in California, as in most of the country, and certainly in the city that I live in, New York, classes are ethnically mixed. They're not always well integrated by race, but they're ethnically very mixed. We have black children coming from the Caribbean as well as from the South, as well as from Africa, as well as having Latin American children who come from all over Latin America and from many different cultures. As well as Asian kids from all over Asia, as well as Asian kids who've been here for generations, and on, we don't have simply in this country five cultures. We don't have a white culture, a black culture, a yellow culture, a red culture, and a brown culture. We have hundreds of cultures. And so if you say that we're going to teach you the culture of your ancestors, this is, first of all, pedagogically impossible in a classroom with 25 to 40 children, where there might be 25 to 40 different cultures. It isn't even possible in most cases for individual children, where their parents may come from different cultures and their grandparents may come from yet other cultures. So I think that I'm not arguing the melting pot. I'm arguing the salad bowl, the mosaic, the multi-textured tapestry, call it what you will. We are too culturally diverse to call ourselves five races and therefore five cultures.
Now, the curriculum that you helped draw up in California has been very controversial. There have been objections raised by black groups, Jewish groups, gay groups. What kind of issues did they raise, and how did you respond to them?
Well, the attack on the curriculum comes about not, I think, because of flaws in the curriculum, but because in this country we have a system of lay control of education, and since everybody at some time or another has been to school, everyone sees himself as an expert on schooling as well as an expert in his or her own particular culture. The basic thing is that everybody wants to write their own treatment. Religion, for instance, has not been in American textbooks for a generation. And there have been several studies saying that it's a disgrace that American kids in their history classes, whether they're learning world history or American history, religion doesn't exist. Now, there's a reason that religion doesn't exist. It's because it's controversial. And there has been a trend of extremist groups criticizing the schools for years. And the result of not just the schools, but the textbooks, and particularly the textbooks, the result of these extremist criticisms is textbook publishers studiously avoid anything that might be remotely controversial because they don't want to face the criticism. They don't want to have their textbooks labeled as controversial because they know that it'll kill their sales. And so we have these massive textbooks of 800 to 1,200 pages for kids in the eighth grade who study American history, kids in other grades who study American or world history. And the biggest criticism of them is that they're boring. Why are they boring? All the controversy has been dropped out. And that's why our curriculum was very path-breaking, because we said specifically, if you textbook publishers leave the controversy out, your books will not be appropriate for adoption. We want controversy. We want children to see different points of view. We want them to be able to see the process by which these controversies were settled.
I'm wondering if some people fear that the kind of multiculturalist curriculum you're talking about isn't writing through the vantage point of white Americans describing different cultures, so all the other cultures are always the outsider culture.
Well, I think that's a legitimate concern, and I think that I didn't write the textbook, so I can't say what their vantage point is. I know that they have a lot of primary source material written through the eyes of people of various cultures. In the anthology, The American Reader, what I tried to do is not to do anything through my vantage point other than the introductions, which is inevitable. But I have a lot of material by African Americans. I have a lot of material by people of other ethnic groups and by women. And, of course, it's their words.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Diane Ravitch, and she's written extensively about education. We'll talk about some more education issues after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Diane Ravitch is my guest. She teaches history and education at Teachers College, Columbia University in New York. Her new book, The American Reader, is an anthology of classic speeches, poems, and songs that she feels should be taught in the schools. Ravitch has been active in advocating and developing new multicultural curriculums for public school systems. New York State's history curriculum is in the process of revision now. And you've written some critical statements about the way the curriculum is progressing. I know there's probably a lot of really complicated inside stuff here, but if you could give us an explanation of your criticisms, an explanation that those of us who aren't intimately involved in this would appreciate.
Basically, the question in New York State is that there have been criticisms that the curriculum as it stands, the state curriculum as it stands, is Eurocentric and biased. And I was one of the people called in to review the report that made these charges. and I reviewed the curriculum, and I thought it was one of the most boring curriculums in the country. But I did not think it was biased, and I did not think that it was Eurocentric. This was a curriculum that was revised in 1987, and at that time, the biggest complaint about the 1987 curriculum that came out at that point was that it had reduced the role of Western Europe to a point of being almost insignificant. And there were letters and petitions sent to the state commissioner in 1987 because the old curriculum had had 1 year of Western European history and 1 year of non-Western history, and the new curriculum reduced Western Europe to one quarter of 1 year. So a number of people who teach European history throughout the state wrote and complained to the state commissioner that the kids would come to college not knowing any European history at all if all it was a quarter of 1 year. So then when 2 years later this very same curriculum was assailed as being Eurocentric because this is a curriculum in which Western Europe and Africa get equal time, I found it hard to take seriously the charge that this was Eurocentric, particularly because, as I said, I did read the curriculum and I did read the task force report, and there were no particulars evidence. There were just a series of charges. The charges were that, you know, that it was biased, that it was Eurocentric, that all white people have oppressed all people of color for centuries, etc. But this does not consist of a bill of particulars.
Is the curriculum being rewritten in response to the criticism that it's too Eurocentric?
Yes.
So that's the point of the rewriting.
Right, yes. In response to the original task force, which claimed that the curriculum is biased and Eurocentric, a new committee to revise the curriculum was created, and it has 22 or 23 people on it, and they've been charged with reviewing the curriculum, and they have met a few times, and I don't know what they will do, but I assume that they will come out with revisions. You have to understand that any curriculum can always be revised. We never have a perfect curriculum. Every curriculum can be improved.
This fear that the curriculum is Eurocentric, you know, that criticism, do you think that that's in a way a symptom of how segregated the New York City schools are and the schools of many cities? In the sense that, as I know, in a lot of schools there is true multiculturalism where there are people of a lot of cultures, but really in a lot of the cities there's a lot of schools that are 98-99% black, and that isn't reflected in any of the learning materials.
Well, the question is, to what extent should the learning materials reflect the racial composition of the classroom? And if a class is, let's say, 100% black, or if a school is 100% black or 99% black, should it have a curriculum that's completely Afrocentric? Should those children therefore learn nothing about anything other than black Americans, African Americans, and Africa? And conversely, should children who attend a school somewhere, wherever, there, if there is a 100% school somewhere, should they learn only about the white part of American history as well as only about Europe? And I would say that both of those things would be wrong because it doesn't reflect reality and it's historically inaccurate. Those are both biased presentations. Children who are growing up in this country need to learn about American history as it happened, which is that it was that the African-American role in American history was very significant, and whether the school is 100% white or 100% black, the American history that's taught ought probably to be roughly the same, because Frederick Douglass should be as important in the white school as he is in the black school, even though he may assume more importance in the black school because he's a role model. But I would argue that he's a role model in the white school as well, because this is a man of intelligence and courage who would be a role model to the child who is Asian or white or Hispanic or anything else.
My guest is Diane Ravitch, and she's written extensively about education. She's also helped revise California state curriculum. She has a new anthology, a multicultural anthology called The American Reader. Where do you stand on extending the school year? This is an issue that's been coming up for years, but it seems to be getting raised very seriously right now.
Well, I think that I stand strongly in favor of extending the school day. I have written in New York about, I think it was the president of the Board of Education, Gwendolyn Baker, suggested that there should be a longer school day. I happen to believe that that's more important than a longer school year.
Well, why a longer school day? I couldn't imagine myself staying in school any more hours than I already did, you know, in high school and in junior high. There's only a certain amount of time you could sit in a chair and absorb things, especially when you're young and you have all that physical energy.
I think what's happened now is the school day has been shortened to the point where kids just don't have enough time to learn. In New York, the kids get out of school at 2:20. A lot of kids have no place to go when they get out unless they go to work in a job somewhere. But a lot of kids, especially younger kids, have no place to go because one or both parents are working and no one's home. So they're on the streets, they're latchkey kids, and all these facilities in the schools are closed up. And what I've thought would make a lot of sense in an extended day would be to have available people to help kids with their homework, to have computers available, to have foreign language instruction available, to have arts classes, dance classes, any number of things, sports, whatever. But this would be a period that would be tremendously useful to kids, and I think it also would be very important for parents to know that their children were being taken care of and protected rather than out on the streets because the school door got locked at 2:20 or 2:30.
And so I know you'd rather see that than extending the school year, but do you think extending the school year would be a good idea?
Oh, I think that it's just such a deeply ingrained tradition mm-hmm. that everyone has the summer off that I'm not sure that that's going to work. I know that in Los Angeles, where it's been tried, they seem to feel that it's successful, but they haven't really extended the school year so much as they've put everyone into year-round classes, and you get the same amount of time off, but you just take the time off at a different point rather than in the summertime. I think the big problem is that given the amount of time we have, I just don't think there's enough time in the day. I also think that it would be good if schools opened at 7. I've seen, again, some experimental schools that were open from 7 in the morning till 7 in the evening, where the parents could have the satisfaction of knowing that when they dropped their kids off at school on the way to work, that the children were at school and they were not getting into trouble or that they were not in danger. And they knew that in afternoons the kids had some good activities to choose among. I'm not saying that kids should be sitting at a desk from 7 to 7.
Some of these hours would be optional, I hope.
The schools that I've seen it in, I'm thinking now of a school in an experimental school in Chicago. It's really a benefit for the parents because they have young children ages 3 to 7, and the parents leave for work at 7:30, and if mm-hmm. in the normal school, they can't drop their kids off at 7:30. So this way, it's really a way of having the school help the parents out. And I think when you see what's happening in many of our cities and suburbs and other parts of the country where the family is in different stages of disarray, I think that there could be a different role configured for the school.
Let's try to end on a really positive note. What gives you the most hope about the future of American schools?
Well, I think that the most hopeful sign is that we've begun to recognize some of the problems. I think that we have some really super people who are teaching and who have more courage and fortitude than almost anyone I've ever met. Every time I'm in a school, I'm impressed with not everybody there, but an awful lot of the teachers, and with the willingness that they have to fight for literacy and to struggle to get across what they have to do. I guess that I have to say that there are times when I despair because I feel that parents are not playing the role that they should play, and an awful lot of parents despair because they feel overwhelmed by the burdens of work and parenthood and everything else. But I think that the best sign of hope is the fact that people are talking about the problems, are trying to do something about it, and I don't think the problems are going to be solved unless an awful lot of people pitch in.
Well, Diane Ravitch, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Diane Ravitch is a historian of education. She's written extensively about American education, and her new book is a multicultural reader called The American Reader. Next time, British journalist Robert Fisk. Fisk has been covering Lebanon for the past 14 years. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, bringing emotional realism to the stage, a talk with Wendy Smith, the author of A New History of the Group Theater, a collective whose politicized and soul-searching approach to acting has had a lasting influence on American theater and film. Also, rock historian Ed Ward traces the career of John Cale, a classically trained avant-gardist who first made his mark on rock with the Velvet Underground. And John Leonard reviews a new book on one of the great marvels of the ancient world, the city of Angkor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee today began hearings on Persian Gulf policy. Tomorrow, the panel will hear from Secretary of State James Baker in defense of Bush administration actions. Today, the panel heard from more critical voices. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
Have patience with the economic sanctions. Don't rush to war. That was the message delivered today by former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. In his tenure in the cabinet of Lyndon Johnson, McNamara often testified before the Foreign Relations Committee as it grew increasingly critical of the Vietnam War. Then he defended the use of force. Today, McNamara argued that the post-Cold War world demands the use of economic sanctions to quell aggression because the American people do not want this country's military to act as an international police force. McNamara and other panelists also contended that President Bush should seek the approval of Congress before going to war because, said presidential scholar Arthur Schlesinger, if he can carry the Congress, he can carry the country. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Former top thrift official M. Danny Wall testified before the Senate Ethics Committee today, the 11th day of hearings on the so-called Keating Five's involvement with former savings and loan operator Charles Keating. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Wall testified that he received an unusual number of telephone calls from senators on Keating's savings and loan, but that nothing improper was ever said. Wall is a former Republican Senate Banking Committee staffer who became the top thrift regulator in 1987. He testified today that no political figure tried to influence his decisions regarding the failed savings and loan. Arizona Democrat Dennis DeConcini's attorney read today from Wall's affidavit.
Their inquiries were for a status report or to urge action, but in no way were they attempts to tell me what action to take. Do you remember giving that testimony?
Yes, sir.
And I take it was correct at the time that you gave it last year?
Yes, sir.
And do you affirm that testimony today?
Yes, sir.
The ethics panel is investigating allegations that the five senators improperly intervened with regulators on Keating's behalf. Tomorrow, they'll hear the testimony of a San Francisco bank regulator. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Sky Television News in London is reporting that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein is willing to pull out of Kuwait to avoid war if he is allowed to keep an oil field captured during the invasion. The TV network says that the offer will be made to Secretary of State James Baker when he visits Iraq later this month. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 14 points to close at 2,579.70, volume 186 million shares. Trading today was active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Musician John Cale turns 50 tomorrow, and rock and roll historian Ed Ward, who has crossed paths with him over the years, says Cale's one of his favorite songwriters. Today, Ed looks at Cale's beginnings.
John Cale was born in Garnet, South Wales, and as a young music student at London's Guildhall School of Music, fell in love with the American avant-garde. He came to the U.S. in 1963 on a Leonard Bernstein scholarship to study with Aaron Copland and Yannis Xenakis, but quickly fell in with the radical composer Lamont Young. Young was fascinated with Indian music and found Cale's viola a perfect component for experiments like American Radio, of which this is an excerpt. But Kel was looking elsewhere, too, and when a fledgling Tin Pan Alley songwriter named Lou Reed asked him to join his band, The Primitives, Kel agreed. Soon, they were sharing an apartment, and Kel was encouraging Reed to go with some of his weirder ideas, including a song about the joys of heroin, which featured Kel's viola drone quite prominently.
I don't know just where I'm going. Try for the kingdom if I can, 'cause it makes me feel like I'm a man when I put a spike into my vein. And I tell you, things aren't quite the same when I'm rushing on my run, and I feel just like Jesus' son. And I guess that I just don't know. And I guess that I just don't know.
Soon, the band changed its name to the Velvet Underground, and not long after that, they became a part of Andy Warhol's circle. Kel made two albums with the Velvets before he quit in 1968, possibly because he was tired of playing second banana to Reed. He didn't lack for work, though. He produced the debut album by the Stooges, a Detroit band who were way ahead of their time, and played his famous viola drone on a long track called We Will Fall that had people tearing their hair out. Then, he surprised everybody by releasing a solo album on Columbia, Vintage Violence.
Manager is waiting to be paid, along with priests and deacons of this court. A quartermaster, quartermaster, a mistress of the lines, found along St. Avenue.
It was lush, it had country touches, and it had astonishing melodies. Obviously, there was another John Cale nobody had heard yet. Warner Brothers snapped him up to work as a talent scout and producer. One of his first projects was an album by Nico, the German chanteuse who'd been in the Velvet Underground with him. Clearly influenced by American minimalist composer Terry Riley, Kel made such ridiculous songs as Janitor of Lunacy worth sitting through. Warners also gave him time to make a classical record, The Academy in Peril, and a pop album, Paris 1919, which was a real masterpiece.
She makes me so unsure of myself, standing there but never ever talking sense. Just a visitor, you see, so much wanting to be seen. She'd open up the doors and vaguely carry us away.
Kel also learned that he'd rather not be a corporate employee ever again. Fear, he once told me, was a song about working at Warner Brothers. He went on to make some spectacular albums, including Fear, and a live collaboration with Nico, Brian Eno, and others, on which he premiered his suicidally lugubrious, slowed-down version of Heartbreak Hotel. He was also in demand as a producer, and did the first efforts by The Modern Lovers, Squeeze, and Patti Smith. Kel was also becoming increasingly paranoid and hard to deal with, and although that could and did result in some harrowing performances and records, it also meant putting up with a lot of weird talk about the CIA, the military, and Doomsday. In the early 80s, though, John Cale got married, and the last time I saw him, a year or so ago, he was in fine shape again, performing solo and writing new songs. He collaborated with Lou Reed on a tribute to Warhol, Songs for Drella, and, I think, walked away with it. And just a few weeks ago, he released an album of songs written with Brian Eno, which I'm embarrassed to say I haven't really sat down to listen to yet. I know, I'll do it as a birthday celebration. So, happy birthday to John Cale, and for the rest of you, most of these records are still in print.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Since my baby left me, I found a new place to dwell. Down at the end of a lonely street, Heartbreak Hotel.
This is Fresh Air. The Actors Studio is famous for having taught the method to such actors as Marlon Brando, James Dean, Paul Newman, and more recently Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. The Actors Studio was founded by three former members of a collective that revolutionized American acting in the 1930s, the group theater. My guest Wendy Smith has written a history of the group theater called Real Life Drama. The group theater introduced the teachings of the Russian director Stanislavski to this country. The group reacted against the superficiality of Broadway. They were artistically and politically radical and sought out plays that spoke to the issues of the day. The group theater was founded in 1931 by Harold Clurman, Lee Strasberg, and Cheryl Crawford. They met while working at the Theater Guild, which was one of the most distinguished theater companies of the 20s.
The Guild was a place that did, you know, sort of serious drama, both European and American, and it had a wonderful track record. But they were dissatisfied with it. They felt that it was just sort of too arty and not concerned enough with real issues. It didn't sort of provide proper training for its actors. And they wanted a theater that was sort of more socially aware, more socially involved. And they also wanted a place that would be a home for actors, not just a place where they work, but a place where they could really express their deepest beliefs. This was also true for playwrights. So they came together. In the beginning, Harold Clurman gave a group of talks in November of 1930 through the spring of 1931, defining what he felt the theater could be. And these talks, many people said, were the most inspiring thing they had ever heard. They were tremendously excited by his vision of the theater and his belief in what they could do with the theater. And that brought a group of actors together who then went away for the summer in 1931 to explore this new technique that Lee Strasberg was basically teaching them based on the Stanislavski system, and also to get to know each other and to find out what they could do together.
These actors really believed that theater was the most important art form.
Absolutely.
What set theater apart from the other arts in their minds?
I think to them it was the most human art form. It involved an exchange between the artists on the stage and the people in the audience. It was alive in a way that no other art is. You know, you read a book, you look at a painting, you do that alone. But the theater is a really electric form of communication. And in fact, there were instances in the group's history, the most exciting being the premiere of Waiting for Lefty in 1935, where the audience was so swept up in what the actors were doing. This was a play about a taxi strike, and the audience became so involved in the story and so swept up by the characters that at the end of the play, a character on the stage demanded, "Well, what's the answer?" And a couple of people who were planted in the audience, actors, were supposed to answer, "Strike, strike." And instead, the entire audience, 1,400 people, leapt to their feet and yelled, "Strike, strike," and then burst into applause and cheers that lasted for 45 minutes. So this was a kind of exchange that nothing but the theater could give you, and this is what the group was looking for.
The group brought the Stanislavski technique to America. What was the technique? What made their acting approach different from other actors?
Well, it's been that Stanislavski's technique has been discussed over and over again, and it causes enormous controversy, and I certainly am not an acting teacher, but in essence, when the Moscow Art Theater came to America in 1923, what impressed people who saw them the most was the tremendous realism of the productions, the emotional intensity of the acting. I mean, it didn't seem like acting. It seemed real. And what the group tried to do and what they used the Stanislavski system to do was to bring the actor's personal emotions into a part. There's a technique called emotional memory, which was quite central in the group's early years, although there was a good deal of controversy about it later, where you sat down and in order to bring, you know, if you wanted to be angry in a moment in a scene, you sat down and you thought of a moment in your actual life where you had been angry and you tried to recreate it, what the room looked like, who was in the room with you, what you were talking about, how you felt.
It was not only the acting style and the types of plays associated with the group that broke with tradition, it was the relationships as well. This is a group that tried to function very collectively. In what ways did they manage to achieve the collective spirit that they strove for?
Well, for me, that was the thing that was most compelling about the group, and I think their greatest achievement really was that they did create a collective which worked together for 10 years, which is an incredible amount of time in the American theater, and which really, I say in the book that the group functioned best as a peculiar mix of dictatorship and democracy, and I think that was true. They were content, for the most part, to leave the decisions to the directors, the principal ones, Clurman, Strasberg, and Crawford. But whenever there was a very important policy issue, perhaps letting an actor go to do a play outside the group, then the whole group would get together and make these decisions. The directors didn't necessarily always like this, but the whole spirit of the group sort of demanded that, and it made... They spent summers together working on their plays. They had a very long rehearsal period, 11 or 12 weeks, which was unheard of on Broadway. The usual rehearsal period was 4 weeks. They spent the summers together, and they got to know each other as people as well as actors. Relationships were very close, very intense. There were love affairs. There were marriages. There were feuds within the company sometimes, usually often over technical issues involving the acting. And they created a very warm and supportive environment in which they could really experiment and grow.
I want to get back to something you said before. You said that the idea of emotional memory mm-hmm. as an acting tool became controversial later on.
Oh, yes. In 1934, Stella Adler came back from Paris. She had been very unhappy about the use of emotional memory, which, as I say, involved delving into your personal emotions. She had felt that it sort of stifled her as an actor. She was very unhappy on stage. She found her work very joyless. And she went to Paris where she met Stanislavski, and she said to him, "Before I knew about your system, I loved the theater, and now I hate it." And Stanislavski worked with her for 5 or 6 weeks, going over what she had learned about the method. And what Adler learned from Stanislavski was that emotional memory, although very important, was not the only thing in his technique. And she came back to the group and said, "We have overstressed emotional memory. Much more important is the through line of action in a play, the super objective it's sometimes called. It's not just real emotion that's important. You have to know what your character is doing. You have to be in tune with the long-term objectives of the play." A great many group actors were very relieved to hear this. There had been incidents of people doing emotional exercises being so traumatized that they couldn't speak for days. I mean, you know, you were sort of dabbling with psychological forces that no one in the group was really trained to cope with. So it had been frightening for people, and I think they had their doubts about it. And when Adler came back from Stanislavski and said, you know, this is not what we should be doing, they were quite relieved. However, Strasberg was furious, and he came up a day or two later and gave a lecture in which he, in essence, said, "We don't practice the Stanislavski system. We practice my method, and emotional memory is the cornerstone of it." And there was quite a rift within the group. Strasberg and Adler had never gotten along very well, and they didn't get along well after this. And in later years, they relied on emotional memory much less and used other elements of the Stanislavski system more. people like Stella Adler and Sanford Meisner and Robert Lewis today do not use emotional memory in their work. They don't consider it an important element. The Actor's Studio still, you know, that's still an important part of what you do at the Actor's Studio. And people, you will get a bunch of actors together and mention the words emotional memory, and you'll still get a very lively argument about it.
Why did the group start to fall apart in the late 30s?
Very difficult question, very complicated. The easy answer is that the kind of company they had achieved, the work they had done over 10 years, was basically impossible, and they had done it anyway. The entire setup of the American theater simply is not conducive to a permanent company paying actors on a year-round basis, producing plays with consideration basically for their artistic merit and as part of a program of plays rather than for their commercial potential. And after 10 years, people were older, they had families, they had responsibilities, they'd gotten all this praise, they were getting movie offers, and they were still broke. I think that it really, there were just too many forces pulling the group apart that had always been there, but that the strong central core of belief keeping them together wasn't there. That partly had to do with a split in 1937 when Lee Strasberg and Cheryl Crawford resigned and Harold Klerman remained as the sole director. In my mind, the group was never quite the same afterwards. Klerman was a wonderful man, the inspiring force in the group, but he needed the practicality of Crawford. He needed Strasberg's sort of domineering and difficult but real attention to detail and to classwork and all. Without them, the group began to be, it just was not the same, and it also began to be a slightly more commercial operation, which distressed many of the actors. All of a sudden, there was a lot of suspicion and unhappiness about how the group was run. They didn't have the same faith in the company anymore, and I think people were tired after all those years.
Where do you really see the mark of the group today?
Well, I think they revolutionized American acting, and whatever technique you use now, any American actor has gotten the idea that you must study and train yourself as an actor. That is something the group introduced into American acting. They were people who believed very deeply in art, and they believed that art could have an impact in the world, that an artist had a responsibility to say something about the society he or she lived in, and that an audience wanted to hear these things, wanted to engage real life in art. So I would say that that's the thing that continues to, you know, really be important about the group as a historical incident.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks. It was lots of fun.
Wendy Smith is the author of Real Life Drama, The Group Theater and America, 1931 to 1940. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is joining us from NPR in Washington. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we have a piece from the Middle East on Saddam Hussein's meeting with the foreign ministers of the Arab states, which remain sympathetic to him. We'll be looking at that plane crash in Detroit, two aircraft on the same runway, and how that may have happened. We have a long and thoughtful and very interesting piece on health care and the poor, which points out, among other things, that most of the health problems poor people have are problems which have been solved, but the health care is not being delivered to them. We're also going to take a look at the murder capital of the U.S., which is the capital city of the United States.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic John Leonard has a review of a new book about the Cambodian archaeological site of Angkor that he says captures much more than eroding stone.
I don't ordinarily buy into any of the coffee table books for Christmas racket, but Angkor, The Hidden Glories, at 260 outsized pages for $45, is a gorgeous bargain. A stunning portfolio of color photographs by Michael Freeman, with an elegant and scrupulous text by Roger Warner, part reportage and part historical monograph. It adds up, between covers, to an act of the romantic imagination. Something about Angkor inspires excess, melancholy introspection, savage ideologizing, and literary vapors. We are talking about 60 square miles of collapsing temples in the Cambodian jungle, about a Khmer culture that flourished in Southeast Asia from the 9th to the 15th centuries and left us golden lions and golden Buddhas, corncob towers and sea serpent cults, pyramids and cat's eyes, a sandstone cosmology, and a vision of 32 hells. So grand and mesmerizing are these bare ruined choirs of a bygone civilization, full of bats, attacked by banyan trees, that European visitors assume they're left over from ancient Romans, or ancient Hebrews, or Alexander the Great. But they were made in Cambodia, by Cambodians, in the same command economy of slaves that created the irrigation system that produced the surplus that raised a Khmer army to terrorize its neighbors. We see through culture-bound eyes. The young novelist André Malraux went to Angkor Wat in 1923 to steal some stone ornamental dancing girls. Imagine a young Cambodian poet stealing some stones from the Parthenon. More than four decades after Malraux, Jan Myrdal, the Marxist son of the Swedish sociologist Gunnar Myrdal, found in the same tombs evidence of the impending collapse of corporate capitalism. It still hasn't happened. 20 years after Myrdal, journalist Warner and photographer Freeman can't approach the colossal head of Brahma without an escort of Vietnamese soldiers with automatic rifles. And they're surprised to find that, contrary to rumor, a bloodthirsty Khmer Rouge had let the temple stand after overrunning them, maybe because they identified with the brutal kings of the ancient culture. History never reads us the lesson we want to learn. It insists on mystifying, like those dancing girls, whom the poet Claudel accused of dancing a kind of sinister can-can over the ruins. According to Warner, the cities, most of them bigger than Rome at the time of Nero, and the palaces, built to celebrate successive god kings, vanished because they were made out of wood. But the temples, intended to recapitulate architecturally a Hindu model of the universe, with six rings of mountains, seven oceans, a rainbow bridge, a balustrade of Naga serpents, and a five-peaked god summit, are still to be seen today in golden decay, after a lot of hassle, and for how much longer nobody knows, as jungle vegetation swarms to devour them. And see them we do through Freeman's lens, in shadow and dazzle, at sunset, and in some other light, an apprehension like Ozymandias. It is difficult, wrote Osbert Sitwell of Angkor Wat, for someone who has not seen it to picture so wild and ramshackle a confusion of animate and inanimate, of rampant green life at war with immobile gray death, golden death. Indeed, the stone itself acquires a kind of life from the struggle, for it is caught between two fires. That's what these photographs look like, and so was my imagination caught, between fires, in a habitat of departed lions and gods.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Angkor, The Hidden Glories, by Michael Freeman and Roger Warner. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy, Roberta Sharrock, and Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the Middle East and the Gulf crisis with one of the two Western journalists still living in Beirut, Robert Fisk. Also, Richard Sandomir takes a head-on look at baldness. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.